I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. According to the New York Times, more than 106 million Americans are fully vaccinated against coronavirus, and 148 million, that's 56% of adults, have received at least one shot. The country is averaging 2.19 million shots a day. That's a drop off from last month. The Biden administration is now focusing on community outreach to go where people are, especially in high-risk neighborhoods, to get the country closer to herd immunity. The FDA is expected to okay the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for adolescents as young as 12 sometime next week. New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut announced that they are loosening their pandemic restrictions starting on May 19th, while Pennsylvania is lifting all its pandemic restrictions on Memorial Day. Philadelphia is figuring out its own timetable. The CDC recently announced that the fully vaccinated can enjoy the great outdoors without masking and distancing, among other perks. That is the good news. There are, though, still millions of Americans who refuse to get vaccinated against COVID-19 for a whole host of reasons. Today on Radio Times, where things stand with coronavirus and nudging vaccine resistance. And we begin with Dr. Lena Wen. She's an emergency physician, a public health professor at George Washington University. She's a contributing columnist for The Washington Post and a CNN medical analyst. She previously served as Baltimore's health commissioner. She joins us by Skype. Dr. Wen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to join you, Marty.
What is this place that we are in right now? About a third of the nation is fully vaccinated. We clearly are not at herd immunity. So we are not completely at the mercy of this virus, and yet we've got a long way to go. What do we call this place that we're in?
That's exactly right. We are in this in-between time right now when we are seeing many signs of hope, but it's not the end of the tunnel by any stretch of the imagination. On the one hand, we do have, thankfully, an ever-increasing rate of vaccinations, and we're also seeing the rate of infections begin to drop. But on the other hand, we still do have tens of thousands of Americans getting infected every day. We have hundreds of people dying every day. And I really hope that people will think of themselves as, if you're fully vaccinated, there's a lot that you can now do safely. But those who are not vaccinated should still know that this is a dangerous time for them. We have variants that are dominant. The B117 variant, the one coming from the UK, is dominant here in the US. It's more contagious. It's more virulent. We're also seeing that younger individuals, because they tend to be the ones who are not yet vaccinated, are getting, they're the ones getting infected at higher rates and getting hospitalized at higher rates. And so I really hope that those who are not yet vaccinated won't look at this picture and say, well, it's time that I let down my guard too. Actually, this is the time for those who are not yet vaccinated to keep on guard until they can also be inoculated too.
Well, let me pick up on the fully vaccinated, and we did want to focus at least on some good news, having you on the show, Dr. Wen. But for people who are fully vaccinated, they're past that 2-week post-vaccination time period, what can they do safely?
Well, I actually think that they can do a lot more, even more than the CDC is saying. I think the CDC guidance thus far has been very cautious and perhaps understandably so. I can imagine that they don't want to retract their guidance. They want to wait until there is sufficient evidence. The problem, though, is when you wait for as much evidence as possible to come in, potentially you could also lose people's trust in that time when the guidance that's being put out isn't meeting people where they are. So here's what the CDC says can be done safely. Certainly, anything outdoors is very safe for fully vaccinated people. And the CDC is saying that fully vaccinated people can basically do anything outdoors, including without wearing masks, unless they're in outdoor crowded settings with a lot of people around them. Indoors, fully vaccinated people can see one another for dinner parties. So that means indoors without masks if they're around only others who are fully vaccinated. They can also see people who are not fully vaccinated indoors if it's one household at a time. So grandparents who are fully vaccinated can see their unvaccinated grandchildren, but ideally they're not mixing households. So unvaccinated people are not getting together with one another. I actually think the CDC can go much further than this because frankly, vaccination protects you extremely well. The data from the CDC show that the rate of breakthrough infections, which is infections after being fully vaccinated, is something on the rate of 0.008%. Very low. And of course, the vaccinations also protect you very well against severe disease. So I think at this point, that really depends on people's individual risk tolerance, because some people will look at those data and say, I want to be really cautious still. I don't want to be among the 0.008%. Others are going to look at that and say, if those are my odds, I will go back to everything I did pre-pandemic, go to the gym, go to restaurants. I'm going to see my friends even without a mask. And I actually think that that entire range of behavior is acceptable, and that we should not be judging the fully vaccinated because they truly pose very low threat to the public's health.
And just to pick up on a couple of things. So from your perspective, and you differ somewhat from the CDC, that if you're fully vaccinated, you can essentially return to your life pre-pandemic. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Nguyen?
I think that people should be given that choice, understanding that at this point, at this in-between time in the pandemic, we are not living with the concept of zero risk. We're just not going to get to zero risk. Being around others, there is some level of risk. And so we need to decide for ourselves, based on the medical conditions of our family, those that we live with, whether there are people in our family who are not yet vaccinated. So, for example, I and my husband are still using an abundance of caution, even though we're fully vaccinated, because we have two young kids, 1 and 3, who are not vaccinated. And so we're still using additional caution. But I think there are other people who will say, I'm fully vaccinated. I'm a young adult. I'm in a family that's, we're all vaccinated and we're healthy. We want to go back to pre-pandemic normal. And I actually think that that is okay. We shouldn't judge those who are being extra cautious and mock them for their caution. In the same way, we should not be judging those who want to return to pre-pandemic normal just because we don't dare to take those risks ourselves. Again, those fully vaccinated are not the concern. I'm really concerned about those who are not yet vaccinated for their potential to get ill themselves and their potential of spreading disease.
As you mentioned, the risk once you're fully vaccinated of contracting COVID or getting very sick from COVID are, 0.0008, 0.0001. But I think, we're not statisticians, most of us. And I think we take risk personally, and sometimes it's hard to evaluate. I mean, obviously nothing is risk-free in this world or in this life. But at the same time, I can understand why people hear about a couple of people dying from the J&J vaccine and thinking, I gotta protect myself.
Well, I think when it comes to vaccines, we now have well over 100 million Americans here in the U.S. who have received Pfizer, Moderna vaccine. We have a lot of people, millions of people who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We now know beyond any level of confidence, or with a high level of confidence, that these vaccines are extremely safe. That yes, in a rare side effect does occur, there's a higher risk of this rare blood clotting disorder in a certain group of individuals in young women between the ages of 18 and 49. But those women, people in that category, can choose the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine because this rare side effect is only associated with Johnson & Johnson in this very specific age group that has a higher risk. And so those individuals can choose the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. Over 100 million people have received those vaccines without any of these safety concerns. Now we know that vaccines are extremely safe. They're also extraordinarily effective beyond what we could have possibly imagined at the beginning of this pandemic. And so I really hope that people will look at the situation, for example, of what happened in India or what's happening in India now and what happened in the U.S. back in November, December, January, to see this is what could happen if we do not get everybody vaccinated, and to choose vaccination as something that protects us and allows us to return to pre-pandemic normal.
And I do want to get to that because that's obviously a very important challenge that we all face. But I was also thinking I'm fully vaccinated, but I still put on a mask. I kind of wear it around my chin when I'm walking my dog or I'm outside because I feel like I want to send a message to other people. Whoops. Sorry about that. I do want to send a message to other people that I am pro-max. I am, you know, maxing vaccination. I'm pro-mask. And I want to just make sure that people don't look at me and misunderstand the message that I might be sending out about how I feel about this crisis that we're in.
I think there is a reason for us to signal our belief in public health. Certainly, when masks first began to be the guidance, and while we were in the middle of the surge in the winter and before we had very safe and effective vaccines, I think it was really important for all of us to show why we believe in masks. Right. And to walk around in our neighborhoods and to show others whenever we're in public places that we are pro-mask, we are pro-science, we are pro-public health and protecting one another. I also think, though, that at some point we need to be giving another message, too, which is that vaccines, number one, that vaccines are extremely effective, and number two, that we continue to believe in science. And so when the science says, as the CDC is saying now, that we do not need to be wearing masks outdoors, even if we're not vaccinated, we don't need to be wearing masks outdoors when we can easily physical distance. So if you're walking your dog outdoors and you can easily walk to the other side of the street when there's somebody else sure. near you, you don't need to be wearing a mask. And I actually think that is also sending the right message, because otherwise masks are seen as performative. They're seen as virtual signaling instead of us saying, here's when you do wear a mask. You do need to wear a mask when you're indoors around people of unknown vaccination status. When you're in public places, in a grocery store, you should be wearing a mask. When you're in an airport, you should be wearing a mask. When you're outdoors, you don't need to. And I think sending that clear message of what you can do when is important. And I also think that we need to be sending the message about the importance of vaccination, too.
And we're almost up on a break here. You were critical of President Biden and his joint message to Congress. Everyone was masked up. He took his mask off when he spoke, but he was flanked by, you know, the Speaker of the House and also the Vice President who were masked. And everyone else in that room, you know, 200 out of 1,600 who were there were all masked up. We're almost out of time here, but in terms of our break. But you were critical of that because you felt like it sent the wrong message.
Well, I think that what President Biden could have done instead was to only allow vaccinated people into the joint session of Congress, and then even to give them testing to be extra sure. But then he could have said, you can take off your mask, you can hug one another. This is the kind of pre-pandemic life that we've been missing. We can get it back. We're showing you how to get it back, and vaccination is the answer.
Well, we have a lot of people that want to talk to you, Dr. Nguyen, and we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. That is Dr. Lena Nguyen, and she's an emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. We're talking about COVID-19, of course, about vaccinations, and we do want to talk about how to get people who are reluctant or hesitant to get vaccinated, what to do to encourage them, nudge them to make this decision. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and do stay with us. Be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with public health physician Dr. Lena Nguyen about how to think about risk once we are vaccinated for COVID-19, where we stand in the fight against coronavirus. Dr. Nguyen, we got a lot of comments here. Let me read one from Dave. He says, vaccine skeptics like me are simply weighing the known risks of COVID against the unknown risks of vaccines that are not even fully approved by the FDA. How do you address that reluctance, that skepticism?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And I think that it's really important for those of us who really believe in vaccines and who are big promoters of vaccines to meet people where they are who have these concerns. Don't dismiss them, but actually address them. And I think it is a very good question that people have about, hey, look, these vaccines are new by definition, because this is a new virus. And so how do we know about the long-term consequences? How do we think about the potential of the risk? And I think we need to acknowledge that this is true, that because these vaccines are new, we don't know what long-term consequences there might be. However, we can look back at previous experience with vaccines. We've developed vaccines over the years to all kinds of diseases. There are no long-term consequences. So is there a theoretical long-term consequence of these vaccines? Of course, anything is theoretically possible, but sure, we need to weigh that theoretical risk against the very real benefit of preventing COVID-19 and the very real risk of COVID-19. We know that over 570,000 Americans have died from coronavirus, and that many more people are still living with the consequences of COVID-19, long-term consequences to many of their organ systems. And so people need to think about, is that worry about any theoretical risk that is not based on science or previous experience? Can we weigh that against the very real and known real risk of COVID-19?
Here's a question from Beth. Could Dr. Wang comment on these two scenarios and the risks that they pose? Scenario one, someone who was fully vaccinated but has just gotten off a cross-country flight coming into the home of fully vaccinated family members. That's one. Versus someone who was fully vaccinated but frequently dines inside restaurants coming into a home of fully vaccinated family members. Do you see, are there different risks as you see those two scenarios?
I'd say that both of these scenarios are extremely low risk. The first one is even lower risk than the second for two reasons. One is that risk is cumulative. And so the more higher risk incidences that one is exposed to, or instances that one is exposed to, then the higher risk there is. So somebody who is dining out all the time, let's say every day, is at higher risk than somebody who has one higher risk exposure of being on a plane. That right. said, being on a plane is pretty low risk itself. And also, if you're fully vaccinated, you pose little risk to others, especially others who are fully vaccinated themselves.
President Biden has said that he wants 70% of adults to have at least one dose against the virus by July 4th. First of all, do you think that's possible? I think we're looking at a little bit more than 50% of adults who have at least one shot against the virus. Is that doable? And does that get us closer, or does that put us into herd immunity?
It definitely is doable in the sense that we're talking here about approximately 100 million vaccinations being given in 60 days. We can do that. I mean, that's less than 2 million vaccinations a day. So we can definitely do that. That said, it's not just about the infrastructure at this point. It's not just about initially the vaccines were, if you build it, they will come. All we needed to do was to build the infrastructure and people really wanted to get the vaccine. Now it's harder to convince those who are still holdouts to get vaccinated. It will take a lot more. It'll take a lot more in terms of going to people where they are, having outreach and public education. So it's going to be harder, but I definitely think that it's possible. And I think we need to be aiming high.
Here are a couple of more comments. One from Bill. I would like the experts to be more specific with guidelines. If we're vaccinated, can I pass someone on the sidewalk without being masked? And I don't know how. I appreciate the question, but I also don't know, Dr. Wen, sort of just how specific guidelines can be. Can it be for every possible interaction that we have with another person?
Well, this is the thing. I actually think that the CDC guidelines are way too specific. I think they are overly cautious and too specific, as in, at this point in the pandemic, there is no right answer for all people, even for all people who are fully vaccinated. I think at this point, so much will depend on one's individual risk tolerance and individual medical circumstances. And so the example that the caller gave of passing someone on the sidewalk, there's been zero documented cases. Right. around the world of somebody just giving someone else coronavirus by passing them on the sidewalk. And so I think it's entirely fine, even if you're unvaccinated, to be not wearing a mask and just passing someone on the sidewalk. You're not going to give somebody or transmit or acquire coronavirus that way. But I think there's this huge gray zone in terms of what people are comfortable with once fully vaccinated. That's where I really don't think the CDC should be providing explicit guidance on here you should be wearing a mask, here you should not be wearing a mask. It really depends on people's individual risk tolerance. We should be focused on the risk of unvaccinated people to themselves and to one another, not on the risk of fully vaccinated people.
What about children? I mean, we see that Pfizer is going to probably next week open up vaccinations for teenagers as young as 12. But what about young kids? What, and you have two young children. How should we think about their protection from this virus? And clearly they are not being vaccinated.
I think a lot of that will also depend on parents' choices and their tolerance of risk. For us, as an example, I think we are on the cautious side because of our young children, because I have a baby who just turned one. And, you know, we're choosing to be cautious, but at the same time, I have my 3.5-year-old playing with other kids outdoors without masks. I'm comfortable with. However, if we are indoors with unvaccinated people, I would make sure that everyone is wearing masks. I would feel comfortable with a short haul flight with my two kids, but we have family in South Africa that requires an 18-hour flight. And I don't feel comfortable at the moment with the variant circulating, with the high risk of coronavirus for my 1-year-old who is unable to be masked for an 18-hour flight to be in that kind of duration. And so I think different families are going to make different types of decisions based on their circumstances. And I would advise people to, again, think about their risk around vaccinated versus unvaccinated people. I would have no concerns with fully vaccinated people fully engaging with our children, coming over, hugging them, dining indoors, no trouble. But if they are unvaccinated, I would not have them in my home without masks.
And obviously, states are doing different things. As I mentioned in my intro, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, they are loosening some of their pandemic restrictions. This would be in a couple of weeks, by May 19th. Interestingly, Pennsylvania is lifting all its pandemic restrictions on Memorial Day. The governor wants everyone to be masked until we hit this 70% vaccination rate. But nonetheless, in looking at some local states here, what are your thoughts about that? What do you think about that?
I think it's exactly right. I think we should be lifting these restrictions, but here's the caveat. I want the clear message to be, if you're fully vaccinated, go and do whatever you want to do. You may not want to do it, but if you want to go to a bar, go to restaurants, go to the gym, etc., go and do that. But if you're not vaccinated, I would try to avoid those settings because you are still at high risk yourself for contracting coronavirus. And so I think there needs to be much better guidance for people who are fully vaccinated versus those who are not. I also hope that there will be additional guidance for businesses that want to open at 100% capacity just for vaccinated individuals. There will be a lot of people who will feel a lot more comfortable, for example, high-intensity gym classes indoors. I used to go to those all the time. I would not feel comfortable going now maskless unless it's in a group of only vaccinated individuals. And so I think there needs to be a lot more thought about, can we help businesses even more by ensuring that those who are attending higher risk settings are all fully vaccinated or have a proof of a recent negative test?
Do you think, and this is an unfair question because you have to look into your crystal ball, but do you think we will be able to eradicate this virus, or is it a matter of learning how to live with it and knowing how to better protect ourselves against it?
In the short term, in the next year or two, there's no way that we will be able to eradicate COVID-19. And that's because there will be COVID-19 circulating around the world. We don't have nearly enough vaccine for the world. And until we do, we're not going to eradicate it. So we're going to figure out how to live with it. We can contain it. We can reduce the level of coronavirus infection to the point that we can essentially go back to pre-pandemic normal. But that will really depend on how well we vaccinate our country. And if people don't get vaccinated, the longer it takes for us to get people vaccinated, the longer it's going to be that we live in this in-between time.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. We wanted to get you on for some time. Hopefully we can get you back. Dr. Lena Nguyen, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Marty. Great to join you.
Nice to have you with us as well. And again, emergency physician, public health professor at George Washington University. Well, while more than 100 million Americans are fully vaccinated against coronavirus, there are still pockets of resistance. According to Kaiser Health News, 60% of Americans said they intend to get fully vaccinated. Almost 18% said maybe, while 22% said no. Men are more reluctant than women, and Republicans, especially Trump supporters, are more reluctant than Democrats. The Biden administration, state and local governments, and public health officials are working on incentives to change their minds. New Jersey, for instance, is offering a shot and a beer for residents who get their first vaccination this month, while some other states are offering cash payments. Will these nudges work? Joining us is Katie Milkman. She's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the host of the behavioral economics podcast, Choiceology. And she's got a brand new book, How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. Katie Milkman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Katie, as a behavioral economist, how do you see vaccine hesitancy or vaccine resistance? And I should say those are two very different things. How do you see them?
Yeah, well, I think of two categories, and I think you pointed this out nicely. There's sort of the movable middle. There's a lot of people who are open to getting a vaccine, maybe some who are just really going to be swayed if we can make it radically convenient. There's some who still need to be persuaded and convinced and cajoled. And then, of course, there's the extreme holdouts. And I frankly think that wasting and spending lots of time there is probably not. Well, it's a waste because there is a small subgroup that we're never going to convince. And so it's not reasonable to try.
So the radical holdouts and the ones, you know, who think Fauci created this virus in a, you know, in a lab somewhere, too, which is absolutely false. Those people, I mean, just there's nothing you can say or do to convince them or change their mind.
It seems like it makes sense to write off the radical group. And that's been, by the way that all vaccine communication long before this has gone. And normally that group is actually pretty small. I've seen estimates that it can be as small as 5 to 10% of the population that are really, really resistant. And so, you know, it's probably small enough and costly enough to change those minds that that's just not a good place for us to spend our time and energy.
And in terms of the persuadables, I mean, so you've got millions of people that, you know, were standing in long lines in order to get the shot. So they were, you know, dedicated, determined to get this vaccination. The persuadables, those in the middle, is it a matter of just knowledge, like explaining some of the science about how these vaccines work? Or is it more about their feelings, whatever those feelings entail?
You know, it depends. And there's people in each of those categories, which is why it's important to have a multi-mode approach. So some people just need to have the conversations with a trusted source, whether that's a doctor or a family member or, you know, a member of their religious group, who can talk to them about their fears and why this is really actually safe and a good idea. And lots of people like them are doing it and have had good outcomes, and how much it improves your health to make that decision. So that's going to be the right approach for some people. But other people, there's different things that will work. I think, you know, the deployment of incentives is a great idea, because especially the groups that we're seeing that have low rates right now, naturally, because they were the lowest on the list, but then now we have to actually convince them to get it, are the younger populations in particular. And they may be groups that aren't as nervous about COVID because it doesn't have as bad of an outcome for these groups. So when we look at those populations, thinking about just radical convenience as an option in our playbook is also important. I think, you know, for a long time, people saw these long lines and that people were spending hours on the phone chasing down an appointment. And I think it needs to be communicated how incredibly easy it is. And in fact, that we can make it easier still. You know, there's a website where you can go find one near you. But I would argue we should be literally giving every American an appointment at a convenient location that they can change but at a, you know, a trusted, with a trusted doctor's office or at their local pharmacy, here's your date and time. And there's research showing that if we do that, for instance, for flu vaccines, it increases the rate at which people show up by about 36%, just simply giving them that time so that it's radically convenient.
Even if they didn't sign up, you hear from your pharmacy and they say, you know, Katie Milkman, you have an appointment tomorrow at 1:30. That's enough. Or at least that's a step.
That's what research has shown works with a flu vaccine. So it seems reasonable to expect that it could work here too. And there's some survey evidence suggesting out of a UCSD study, University of California at San Diego, that the same kind of technique could be effective here. Just, I didn't have to think about it. It's been taken care of for me. All I have to do is walk down the street. Thank you for setting this up. My team actually at the University of Pennsylvania ran a massive randomized controlled trial last fall testing different messaging techniques that we hoped would nudge vaccination. And we were testing it in anticipation of literally today. We wanted to figure out what would work. But we tested on flu vaccines using messaging that we hoped would port very naturally because it wasn't specific to the coronavirus. And we tested dozens of different types of communications with Walmart pharmacy customers, as well as with patients at Penn Medicine and Geisinger Health. And in all three sites, the best performing message simply communicated that your doctor had reserved a vaccine for you. So a very similar, or your pharmacist in the case of Walmart, they had one waiting for you. Very similar kind of communication to what was so effective in this other study I mentioned of giving people an appointment. So this idea that it's taken care of, it's reserved for you, it's set aside, a medical professional has determined this is the right course for you and literally, you know, allocated this to you, and you don't have to do anything except show up, seems like an approach we should take immediately. It's so low cost, and that may bring in a bunch of people who just the radical convenience can help.
We're almost up on a break here, but in New Jersey, they're offering a shot, you know, vaccine, a shot, and a beer. I mean, I think it's a kind of a clever messaging. Do you think, Katie, in 30 seconds or less, that could be appeal to perhaps a younger demographic?
Absolutely. Anything we can do to make this feel like more fun and just more delightful is going to be great.
And that is Katie Milkman. She's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She's got a new book. It's called How to Change: The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. We're going to talk more about the book, but I also want to have her answer some more questions about how we get over the coronavirus vaccine hesitancy and reluctance. And as always, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with the Wharton School's Katie Milkman about how to nudge the hesitant, the resistant to get vaccinated for COVID-19. We've been talking a bit about some of the research she's been doing about health messaging. We'll be talking about whether carrots work better than sticks, and we'll be talking about her new book, How to Change: The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. I wonder about, and there has been some talk, Katie, about, you know, a vaccine passport, that if you are fully vaccinated, and I have one of these little cards that I got that show when I got my vaccinations, that would be your passport, your way that you could go to do some things that people who don't have, who didn't get vaccinated cannot do. Is that a good incentive?
You know, I think it's a reasonable idea, especially because there are already venues that are limiting access on the basis of whether or not you're vaccinated. And if someone were to step in, say the government, and just make it a little easier to actually verify that, it doesn't seem like a bad idea to me. We're going to see it happening naturally, whether or not a policy organization facilitates it, because it's, you know, I was listening before, you were talking with Dr. Lena Wen about how important it is to make sure, for instance, if you're in an exercise class and there's a lot of heavy breathing, that everybody there at this point is vaccinated for most people to feel comfortable in a situation like that, right? So you're going to see things like this happening. And it certainly is absolutely a great incentive for people to recognize, hey, wait, there's things that I can do that I couldn't do otherwise. And they should realize that already, by the way. That should be the way people are thinking already.
They should.
But this makes it more formal.
I wonder, too, about sort of looking at short-term versus long-term benefits. I'm assuming, being human beings, we want immediate gratification. But how do we sort of balance those two issues? And also the idea of protecting yourself. But then there's that larger question about protecting the larger community, people you do not know, protecting your healthcare system so that it doesn't go under, like what is happening in India.
Yeah, which is horrible. Absolutely horrible to watch what's happening. Yeah, there's a lot of different motives that change our behavior. You're absolutely right that the here and now is something we overweight, which is one of the reasons I love seeing things like the beer being offered with the vaccine
beer.
Because it brings like an element of delight to something that is a little bit dreaded. Let's admit, like, you know, I raced to get my vaccine the minute I was eligible, and yet it's not like a fun experience to get vaccinated, but if we can make it fun so it's not something people dread, then anyone who's sort of on the margin in economic terms, they're like, well, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't. If we make it more delightful, then okay, that helps getting the shot win out. So I love things like that. And then in terms of others, sort of the motivation to help others, it is a strong motive. And there have been surveys suggesting that kind of motive, help others, do it for other people, that people find it compelling. But I will say that was not something that performed very well when we tested messages around what would encourage people to get a vaccine. We thought it might, because when you ask people the question, would this motivate you a lot, say yes. But then when it comes to actual behavior, it doesn't seem that people really act on it. So I'm a little bit skeptical. I do think in this case, probably the best communication strategies will be a bit more self-interested and focused on self-interest. And again, I said, as I mentioned, the best performer of the things we tested was simply a really clear communication from your doctor or pharmacy saying, we have one reserved for you, much more effective than not communicating at all. By the way, just sending a simple text message was really helpful. And it did seem to perform better than things like, hey, do it for other people.
You say some interesting things in this book about, you know, people sort of doing things, changing their behavior that is actually something that would benefit them. And maybe they find out that they really want to do it. But you say the closer you are to someone and the more their situation resembles your own, the more likely you are to be influenced by their behavior. So taking that finding and applying it to this vaccine hesitancy, if you know someone who's getting vaccinated and you begin to see the benefits of that, will that change their behavior?
Absolutely. So one of the most powerful forces that influences our decisions is what the people around us are doing. We look around, we see, ooh, nobody I know or respect or trust or who looks like me is doing that. I'm not going to do it. But the opposite is true. When we see everybody's rushing to do something, it makes us feel like we're missing out and we don't want to be left out. And there's sort of two elements. One is there's information. Maybe they've learned things about this vaccine, for instance, that I haven't learned, that make them comfortable with its safety. And I trust people like me to do the vetting right. And so if they're comfortable with it, then I'm comfortable with it. So that's sort of the logical component. And then there's also the sort of, I don't want to be left out component, right? You don't want to be the one person who's not wearing formal wear at a formal wedding, right? Like it's really a very natural discomfort with being the odd one out. And so that psychology can also lead us to follow the crowd. And both of those things are working in our favor right now, frankly, because as it was for a little while, actually, the psychology of scarcity, when there's something that's in high demand and it's hard to get, it becomes more appealing. So we have, of course, seen the numbers change a lot. Last September, only 50% of Americans said that they were open to getting a vaccine. And as the safety data, of course, has had a huge role to play, seeing that these vaccines are incredibly safe, and that they've become widely available and they've been out for longer and we haven't seen crazy things happening. So all of that is part of it. But I also think seeing lots of people like you get it and seeing this these moments of scarcity where everyone was racing to get it, both of those things likely also contributed to the growing number of Americans who are ready to go get their vaccine.
And we've all seen the public service announcements from, you know, celebrities, or we saw was Obama and Clinton and Bush too, all getting their vaccination and talking about why they need it. Interestingly, President Trump, who did get vaccinated, has said nothing about that. But seeing famous people or celebrities or movie stars or athletes, is that effective?
Yeah, and actually, I think that Donald Trump has said things on Fox News encouraging people to get a vaccine. He hasn't been as vocal, and he wasn't part of the campaign, but he has been, you know, when pressed, he's clearly an advocate for it, and I think that's really important and valuable. There's an interesting study out of groups at Stanford and MIT did recently showing advertisements to different populations, and they either showed a Trump talking about how the vaccine is good and you should get it, or they showed Biden, and they showed both of these ads either, or they showed one of these ads actually to either a group of Republicans or a group of Democrats. And then they looked, how did this change people's intentions to get a vaccine? And they saw exactly what you might fear, which is that Republicans who saw Biden said, oh gosh, actually, I don't want that vaccine, even though Biden is talking, you know, Biden's saying I should get it, no thanks. But they saw Trump and they said, oh, okay, I'll do it. Let's sign me up. And the opposite, of course, was true for Biden supporters. And so it does suggest that actually having politicians be the ones who are delivering the message may be exactly wrong, unless we can really target that, that it may be more important to get figures everyone is comfortable with out in front of the media talking about the importance of vaccines, so that you don't have polarization contributing to reactance and backlash and a disinterest in getting vaccinated.
I read that men are more reluctant to get vaccinated than women. Does that surprise you, Katie?
I think we saw the same thing with masks, that men were a bit more reluctant to adopt masks. So based on that, it probably doesn't surprise me. It seems like there's less of a willingness to take the public health measures that will protect you when we look at men. And it's disappointing, but it's consistent.
Yeah. And President Biden also talked about making sure that employees get time off and get paid and get a sick day if they don't feel well after getting a vaccination, which made me think about just some of the structural barriers. This has nothing to do with psychology per se, but just the structural barriers we have to prevent that end up preventing people from getting the thing that they actually may want, or, you know, are willing at least to take a couple of steps to get.
Absolutely. I'm glad that the administration is focusing on that, because I do think it's an important issue that it needs to be, as I said before, like radically convenient to me is a really important thing. And part of radical convenience is that it's not going to cost you wages. It's not going to create a giant hassle for your family, that it's going to be possible for you to take that time away from work without any penalty. So we have to be thinking about all those things, so that this is, again, anyone who's on the margin, they're thinking, oh, I'm comfortable doing it, but we need to take away the but.
Let me just make sure our listeners can join us, because I'm watching the clock here. You can send us an email, any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You have a podcast called Choiceology, which got me thinking about how we feel about mandates and how we feel about decisions that we believe are based on our own choice, that we decide on our own that we want to do something. Help us understand how this could be playing out in some of this resistance and hesitancy.
Yeah, in general, people prefer to have freedom to choose, and I support that general preference. It makes sense, right? Whenever we can possibly make it, leave it up to the individual, I think it's a wonderful thing to do. Of course, when there's an externality in nerd terms, which means you're imposing a cost on someone else with your freedoms, that's when it gets hairy. And we're certainly in a situation like that now. And so it makes sense that we're seeing employers and schools start to think about issuing mandates. My employer, University of Pennsylvania, is requiring all students who come back to campus next year to have proof of vaccination. I think that's exactly the right move. It's not even radical because they've been requiring vaccination against other diseases forever. And so it's just adding to that list. And it's a, you know, it's a tight-knit community. People live in close quarters. It's easy to imagine outbreaks. And so I think it's a great tool in our toolbox and one we should be using. But again, when we can avoid it, it's better to give people freedom. It just can't be avoided in certain situations. And I think a university environment is certainly one of them. Healthcare environments are likely to follow. Some have already. There are also going to be primary schools that are thinking about this, and I think that makes sense as well once the vaccine becomes available for younger kids.
I'm looking at the title of your book, How to Change. Why do we resist change, just broadly speaking?
For so many reasons.
I know. I'm sorry. That's a really unfair question with like 4 minutes to go.
No. It is a great question. It's, you know, change is challenging. It's scary. It requires leaving our comfort zone. But one of the things that led me to write the book and be excited about sharing what science has to say about how we can change is that I actually haven't met anyone who isn't eager to change something about themselves for the better. We're all sort of striving to find ways to improve in some way, whether it's our fitness, our productivity, our wanting to learn a new language or become a better parent or spouse, eat healthier meals, you know, contribute better to the environment. Everybody has these goals and aspirations, and it's tough to achieve them because there's so many forces working against us, from sort of inertia, like the tendency to just go with the flow in your daily routines, to temptation, which often is a barrier to change because the tempting thing that's good for you right now that will bring you happiness right now is not what's good for you in the long run. So there's all these things working against us. And in my book, I try to break down what are the most common obstacles and offer science-based tactics that we've proven can really help overcome those challenges and make change more viable.
Well, let me ask you about a couple before we have to say goodbye. One is called the fresh start effect. Why does that work? And I mean, help us understand what that is and why does it work?
Yeah, well, it's a perfect thing to be talking about right now because the fresh start effect is a finding my collaborators and I have documented that there are moments in our lives when we're more open to change than others. And those moments tend to be moments when we feel like we're at a chapter break. And it turns out the way we think about time is not simply linear. We think about time as if it's organized into chapters, right? As if we're characters in a novel. And, you know, there's the Boston years, the high school years, the college years, the consulting years. Those moments that feel like chapter breaks give us a sense that we have a fresh start and a clean slate and a new beginning, and we're more motivated to make change. And of course, we're sort of about to end, hopefully, this pandemic era in a way, as restrictions are loosened, many of us return to workplaces, many of us have been vaccinated and feel like, okay, we can go see family again or have family to visit. It's this major chapter that we're closing, hopefully again, assuming right. New variants and so on. I should be knocking on wood right now, but as we enter this fresh start, lots of people, I think, will be looking at how can I build a better life when I go back to the office, when I, you know, my children are back in school, when I go back to my regular routines, what can I do better? And that's really exciting. I think there's an opportunity to both learn from the things we've experimented with in this last bizarre year, awful, bizarre year. There's some things that worked better and we can try to take those with us. Some people will not return to work 5 days a week in an office, but will instead work from home and they'll find that better, for instance. But what can we learn and what goals can we strive to achieve with this moment that this fresh start feeling gives us?
And just quickly, temptation bundling. What is that?
Temptation bundling is something I've studied that's a way to make something that you dread, something that feels like a chore, more fun by linking it with something that you really look forward to, a temptation. So I'll give you a concrete example. When I was in graduate school, I found it hard at the end of a long day to motivate myself to do my homework or to go to the gym, which I knew I needed to do to maintain, you know, fitness and mental health. All I wanted to do was indulge in entertainment, right? Binge watch TV or curl up with a novel. And I found a way to solve both problems at once, which was I only allowed myself to enjoy that indulgent entertainment while I was working out. And I started craving trips to the gym and coming home from that exercise rejuvenated, ready to focus on my work because I'd gotten that entertainment fix. So this worked for me, and I've proven in research that it can help other people too. And of course, you can apply it to lots of settings where you're struggling to get yourself motivated to do something that feels like a chore. You link it with something fun, like letting yourself pick up your favorite coffee drink on the way to hit the books at the library, or you could let yourself listen to your favorite podcast while you're doing household chores. So that's how temptation bundling turns chores into temptations.
Well, Katie Milkman, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Fun for us as well and informational. And her new book is titled How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. We also talked with Dr. Lena Wen earlier in the hour. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.